Chair, the Senate, I'm sorry, I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Health Care and Public Affairs to order on January 26th, 3 p.m. Friday. Great to see all of you here.
I'm delighted to call the House Committee on Health Care to order. We'll share, Madam Chair's delight, and see how many people are willing to stay till 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon. First of all, I want to acknowledge that all the members have a packet of written material that's been presented to us. It's on the record now, and we'll enter it and available to you. I also want to point out that it's my intention to finish the public testimony and invited testimony and the continuation of the public testimony by 4 o'clock. We need to have a work session. We need enough time for it, and I expect that it might be an interesting session. So let's roll.
I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 31.
And I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2201. Can we have Bruce Goldberg and Rocky King join us? I think they understand their purpose isn't here to give us an hour of testimony, but to show the flag and particularly to be available to answer questions. They'll have technical people with them to answer questions from the committee. Again, I want to make sure that the committees, both committees, have a sense that they've had enough time to ask the questions that need to be asked on the substantive matters, and let's go. Well, you all will introduce yourself?
We shall. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlink, Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Chairman Sanderson and Chair Greenlink. My name is Jeannie Phillips, and I'm with the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Office of Private Health Partnerships, and obviously you can see Bruce and I need help today, so we brought some people up.
And incidentally, we will, I think, on Monday in the Access Subcommittee have a hearing on the state of both of your programs. So we'll be able to deal on Monday in that subcommittee with a fuller set of activities.
Chair Greenlink, Chair Mona Sanderson. I'm Kelly Harms. I'm with the Office of Private Health Partnerships.
You've heard a lot of testimony over the last several days about healthy kids, and we're not here to repeat anything that you've heard. We'll be very brief. We're really here today to do a couple of things. One, we come as two agencies that have worked together on this for almost a year. And we have had a lot of fun. We've done a lot of hard work, and we've worked really well collaboratively, and we think it's the work that we've done in the spirit of that can hopefully translate into a policy that gets health care for all kids. We're here to just do a couple of things. One is to tell you that administratively, we can do this. We've been working through a lot of the details. There's certainly, like any new program, there'll be more details to be ironed out, but that administratively this can be done. And therefore, we're really here to answer any questions that you might have. Although I would just add one last comment, which is that I think all of us in all of our agencies look forward to the day where we'll be able to have all kids in the state and all people in the state have access to basic health care. Collectively, our staffs have worked for the last several years unable to provide some of the health care services that many people in our state need, and we've actually been working through several years of seeing people cut from services and cut from benefits, and that's hard work, and we really look forward to a time when that will change. And with that, we'd like to entertain any questions that you have.
going to be the silent partner today, Mr. King?
Mr. Chair,
I'll only
be silent to the degree that you don't ask me a question, and if you ask me a question, I will be very happy to respond. Uh-oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that as having worked with the Medicaid Advisory Committee on this plan, both of your agencies have worked very hard in involving stakeholders and trying to work through the nuts and bolts of this. So, you know, I just want to say thank you because you've worked very hard on it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
We'll keep it simple. In here you talk about for FEOP the copay and coinsurance, and other than that, this plan doesn't really address cost-cutting measures. It's not intended to. My question is, how would you expect those to look like in the actual plans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, you're talking about how would the copays and the deductibles look in terms of the private sector component plan above the 200%?
Yes.
Okay, we haven't established the exact amount yet, but they will be limited. One of the things we hear from low-income families or middle-income families, it's the predictability of the expenses that really is an issue for them. If you say you need to budget $100 a month for health care, they can budget $100. What they have trouble with is if it's 51 months, 250 another month. So one of the things that we've tried to do in designing the premium and the benefit on this is really put the predictable cost in the premium. So there will be minimum copays and deductibles that do have some impact on utilization, because anytime you have a copay or deductible, it makes you think, do I really need to do that? But we don't want to make them a barrier, and we want to make them so they're more predictable, especially for those middle-income families. So we haven't really set whether it's $10 or $5 or $1 generic, you know, that kind of detail at this point. But we will be doing it, again, within the mind that they have to be affordable, they have to have some impact on utilization, but the predictability of the premium is what those low-income families said is the most important.
Follow-up, please. In my family circumstance, I figured with the 2007 federal poverty level, which is not what will be used, it'll be 2008, that my household income would be $93,000, and that's in my circumstance. And so I guess I do question the 50% subsidy up to an income of $93,000 in my family circumstance. I understand that. Four kids are you going to have sliding copayment and coinsurance? Is that expected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, in the premiums, there's a sliding premium. It starts, I believe, at 85% up to 50%. So we will have a sliding premium. Now, that's not set in statute. That's a policy decision that the legislature and working through this bill can address. But there is that sliding piece. Above 350% of poverty, which is really self-pay, there will be higher copays and deductibles. So that we don't get into a position where above 350% of the poverty level folks are being subsidized by the lower income portion of it. Bruce, do you want to?
Yeah. Chair Greenlick, Chair Mona Sanderson, Representative Maurer, I think the other issue is that we anticipated that there would be a healthy debate about the appropriate level of subsidies and the appropriate level of copayments. There is no magic number, and I think that it's certainly an item that requires healthy debate. And the bill is written so that debate can be handled both administratively as well as fiscally in a ways and means process, which seems to me where you want to have that discussion, because one of the other issues is when you pass a statute, you're stuck with that one way or another for several years. And I think that providing programs as well as the legislature with the flexibility to manage a program is what you want to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Also, just we don't seem to need it quite yet, but the overflow room today is hearing room C.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was
I was hoping that you could help me with a clarification. I'm glad Representative Maurer asked that question. I've been asked questions over the course of the past week about that subsidy at the higher level. But if I understand correctly, at 350% of the federal poverty level, if there were four children in a family and they were receiving no subsidy, that their payment would be $7,680 per year for the premium if you multiply times 4 times 12 plus copays and deductibles. That doesn't sound a lot like free health care to me. Am I misunderstanding?
Ms. Chair, Representative Gelzer, no, you're not misunderstanding. The one caveat to that is as we start talking with some of the stakeholders and carriers about how to put some of that private sector piece together, one of the questions that we've asked is should there be a family rate? And I don't mean that in terms of the parents, but very often when you buy group coverage, if there's one or more children or two or more children, you get a certain rate. Now, what happens when you do that, because nothing's free, is the individual rate basically subsidizes a family that has more kids. But you are correct that it is not free at that level by any means. It is a substantial amount if you have a large number of children, plus the copays or coinsurance that may be involved.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, Dr. Goldberg and Mr. King, a question I think that will be each of you directed. In regard to the funding mechanism here, as we look at the current configuration with the $181.7 million tobacco tax, $56 million of that, or 30.8%, is directed to human services for the program per se, and then the $22.6 million or 12.4% is directed to administration, is under the Office of Private Health Partnerships, those figures coming from Legislative Fiscal Office. So I'm just wondering, is the administration percentage in this program probably comparative in some point with other administrative charges or operating expenses?
Ms. Chair, Representative Flores, I'm not sure. I'd have to look at those figures. Let me tell you that our total administrative cost for the Office of Private Health Partnerships is about $11 million, a little over $11 million. Of that $11 million, about $6.5 million of that is for outreach, education, and marketing. And of that $6.5 million, about $3.5 million of that really gets down to local communities where we're going to contract with local advocacy groups or whatever it may be to really do a lot of the outreach and assistance. Plus, we have what we call bonus grants. And that's not a good word, but it's about $200,000 or $300,000, I think, that's set aside of that amount to focus on some really key areas where the insurance rate may be very high or there are particular community barriers, Eastern Oregon, for example, that we need to address. So now, in the Office of Private Health Partnerships, there's two components. We have the administrative component, and part of that administrative component is marketing and outreach for the entire program, both that administered through DHS as well as us. And the other part, the $5 million, is to administer about $40 million of subsidies. So we have more than just administration in our budget. We have a large, substantial amount for our subsidies above 200% of poverty.
Chair Greenlick and Chairman Sanderson, Representative Flores, from our perspective, I guess the most simple way to look at this is what we've tried to do as we've put together this program is to build on the administrative structures that we already have, that the children that will be cared for in under 200% of poverty through DHS, it will be the same administrative structure that we currently do. No increased administrative costs other than the costs that come with more and more children. Likewise, we've tried to capitalize on the structure that exists within the Office of Private Health Partnerships and to use that, create a what we believe is a seamless and administratively easy structure behind the scenes so that we've got central points of enrollment and central points of information that happen behind the scenes so we don't have duplicative administrative structures. And then as Rocky indicated, there's some dollars for outreach, which is are put in budgets as administrative costs, but really those are program costs. I mean, that's a cost of doing business, and however much money you want to put into outreach is really a policy decision, and gets more at how much you're looking in terms of penetration and how many kids you're looking to enroll. Less dollars towards outreach and enrollment would mean that the program is likely to reach less numbers of kids.
Yes, Representative Broom.
Thank you very much. I have a quick question regarding those that would be on the higher end of the federal poverty level in this program. So the plan basically mandates that all children in the state are covered by the insurance, which is wonderful. What happens in a situation, and granted, as we go up the scale from 200% to 350%, there's a higher, a reduced subsidy, if you will, and a higher responsibility of ostensibly the parents or the guardians. And this is just a basic structure question, if the kids are mandated to have the insurance, but the parents in that situation either will not, or even with the subsidies, cannot pay their requirement, what happens at that point? Is there a tax lien? Is there...
First of all, Mr. Chair, there is no mandate that you must cover your children. So I hope there's not a misunderstanding there. We're not requiring parents. What we're really doing is putting out a carrot, both a benefit package and some assistance if they need it, and some outreach and hopefully education that really speaks the value of having their children be insured. But there is no mandate. So if a parent chooses not to, other than our conviction and ability to persuade, that's a parent's decision.
Okay. Chairs and Representative Broom, we've actually priced this at looking at the fact that we would anticipate that 95% of children and families would avail themselves of this, that it's not going to be 100% because there will be people that either are unable or choose not to, that we've tried to create a program which makes it accessible to those that want to have it.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, I have a couple of questions. First of all, I want to say that we can tell that a year's worth of planning and then hundreds of years' worth of experience have gone into this, and this is a very well thought out program, and we all want to help the children. But it's a question of implementation. You said a few minutes ago, Director Goldberg, that this is merely a continuation of the plan, the SCHIP plan, the Children's Health Insurance Plan, that presently covers up to 185%, and we're raising that up to 200%. But it's also our understanding that there's 117,000 children that are uninsured, and that about 60,000 of them would qualify for insurance today, even if there was no change. And we've been told that there's going to be $6.5 million spent toward outreach. And so, first of all, why do we have 60,000 children uninsured that couldn't have been insured 5 years ago or 2 years ago? And the second is, once if you're successful and we have 95%, can we provide, do we have the dentists and the doctors to be able to deal with another 100,000 patients that they haven't had in the past?
Chair Greenlick, Chairman Sanderson, Vice Chair Richardson, a couple of issues. Let me take them one by one. One you indicated, why is it in essence that the 60,000 kids who in essence are eligible for the plan now aren't on the plan? There's several reasons for that, a couple of which are addressed in the bill. One is a 12-month enrollment versus 6-month enrollment. Right now, we have a 6-month enrollment for children in the Medicaid program. We just recently, the legislature passed legislation to move us to 12 months for the CHIP program, but the majority of kids are actually in the Medicaid program. So what this bill would do would be to move towards 12-month enrollment, and we know that one of the reasons is children come on and then fall off of the plan because the second reason, which is that it's the 6-month enrollment as well as a very difficult application process. And part of what we're doing, unrelated to this bill, because we're committed to doing it anyway, is to simplify the enrollment process, to move from a 10-page GNE application to a 2-page application. That will enable us to reach more children. And the last piece is outreach. Certainly, our organizations have never been funded sufficiently for outreach. So it's really several things that this program does for the under 200% group, a couple of which we're not doing now because statutorily we can't, and as well as fiscally we've been unable to do. So making some of those structural changes really helps. That's one piece. The other issue you indicated was capacity. We've had discussions with a lot of our provider groups, and you know, in particular, the Medicaid managed care plans are community-based health plans, and they've indicated to us that you know they're eager, willing, and ready to be able to provide access to these children. And then lastly, another piece of this package has been investments in school-based health centers and some other ways to be certain that we can meet the delivery needs of these children. So we've taken these things into account, and we believe we've put together a package that can both provide the financial access for families as well as the access on the ground, the ability to get in and see providers, whether it be at schools or through health plans, wherever children need to get their care.
Let's assume you're very successful, and we all hope that you are, because we feel every child should have access to health care, and you enroll this 100,000 more children, which requires $6.5 million of community-based getting the churches and schools and everyone involved. As that takes place, what you're doing is informing families that this benefit is available. Along with that, meaning in addition to families that have uninsured kids, this information will go to families that have insured kids. We're talking about 117,000 uninsured kids, and we're about to send the message across the state that if your family makes, you have a family with two kids, and you make under $73,000 a year, the state will give dental, optical, and medical care better than you've ever had before, and all you have to do is take them off of your insurance for 60 days and then enroll them in the state plan. Are any of your calculations dealing with the reality that we have very smart families that can see, and employers that can see a tremendous benefit in shifting people from insurance plans to this plan?
We have a smart Mr. King that can answer that.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, Representative Richardson, I think resellers talk about the crowd out, and we have built in a 3% factor that there is going to be some crowd out. One thing she didn't talk about that I want to put on the table, and there's an assumption that if you have a group plan and you find something like the Healthy Kids program that looks like a better deal in terms of benefits, for example, that you can drop your group plan and go 2 months uninsured and go into Healthy Kids. The fact is, that's not the way group coverage works in Oregon. Most of you, I think, are eligible for PEB benefits. And if you call up PEB tomorrow and say, hey, Rocky and Bruce have got a deal, I'm going to take my kids off my plan, and I know it's February, drop them, they'll say, sorry, you can't. The only time you can add or drop children onto a plan is in really two instances, annually at open enrollment. So you could see some decisions at the end of a 12-month period where people say, geez, if I don't sign up. And the second is if you have a qualified family status change, a birth or a death, you can drop or add children there. But just during the year, You can't make a decision to drop coverage on a group market without the employer as a whole dropping it for everybody. So the crowd-out impact, and one of the things they've seen nationally, just has not been a big factor in any of these programs. Rhode Island has had zero period of uninsurance in their program, and they've not been able to demonstrate any measurable crowd-out into the public program. Representative Richardson, it is a risk, and it is an issue that we have to track and watch and come back and report to you on. We believe, though, the evidence is that it's not going to be a major impact.
I would also note for that $73,000 family, the state's not giving them a plan. The state is subsidizing it.
Right.
Yeah. Follow up? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say I think Representative Richardson's points on why we haven't covered kids currently eligible is really right on. And what this is an opportunity to do is to get at the administrative barriers. I know there was a lot of discussion that if we were going to do this, we really needed to fund outreach, so it's in there. I just want to clarify for everyone that even if we did all those things, below money into outreach and administrative barriers, reducing those, we would still need additional revenue to cover those eligible children. Is that correct?
Vice Chair Kotek, that's indeed correct. And that's been one of the barriers has been a financial barrier, and I know people wanted me to be brief, so I'm not going to get into the whole issue of how we do our caseload forecasting and being able to actually forecast that we want to reach this many kids and then funding the ability to do that. We've had a lot of discussions about that, and I hope we continue to have more.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And you both escape with your scalps, which is very important. Like us, right? Is Tom Chamberlain here today? No? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Steve Buxton. Excuse me. Steve? All right. Part of the listed indicted testimony. Good to see Representative Richards.
The committee administrator is right on target.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and Vice Chair Mona Sanderson and committee members. Co-chair, what did I say? Sorry. My name is Steve Buxty, and I'm Senior Policy Analyst and the founder of Cascade Policy Institute in Portland. We're a public policy research organization that works on issues such as health care and other issues before you. Before addressing the Healthy Kids program specifically, I think we can all agree that our current health care system is dysfunctional. We may not agree on the causes, however, and we may not agree on the cures. I have little in common politically with former Governor Kitzhaber, but he has diagnosed many of the problems in our health care system correctly, in my opinion. First, he believes that the two big federal health care programs, Medicare and Medicaid, no longer make sense. He warns that Medicaid has become the single biggest item in most state budgets, and it's squeezing out other programs, which you realize. He understands that employer-based coverage no longer makes sense either, which I agree with. Many people, I think, still don't, but I think he's right on all those counts. Regarding the Healthy Kids program specifically, Dr. Kitzhaber has said that covering all children is an important and worthy goal, but we also need a way to ensure that expanding coverage to kids is financially sustainable over time. Simply expanding insurance coverage does not reduce the escalation in costs that lies at the root of the problem, unquote from Dr. Kitzhaber. He looks at the foundering American healthcare system and sees a sinking ship. Some people are already in the water, including uninsured kids, and need help fast. But he also says that it's not enough to rush out with legislative lifeboats, as he calls them, and pull a relatively few to safety. We still have the ship sinking. Well, I think that Dr. Kitzhaber has diagnosed these major problems correctly. I don't believe that his cure is the answer. I don't think it will work. And you'll be discussing, and we'll be discussing, broader cures to this problem later, not in this bill. Cascade Policy Institute recently published two proposals by Randy Posdina and Steve Gregg, which may be more appropriate health care reforms than the Kitzhaber plan, and we believe maybe more a better solution than the plans that you currently are going to be looking at in the near future. They're in the packet that should have been passed out to you here, and they're also on our website at cascadepolicy.org. But for now, I think putting uninsured kids in a lifeboat may help them in the short run, but it won't help for very long. And the Healthy Kids program could actually make the entire healthcare ship, as Dr. Kitzhaber calls it, sink even faster. And I want to go through some reasons why I believe that may be true. First, paying for kids' health insurance by taxing smokers may make those kids better off, but it will also make the smokers and their families worse off. And I think, as most of you know, cigarette-smoking adults are more likely to be uninsured than non-smoking adults. Thus, the cigarette tax will be targeting some of the very people who already can't afford insurance for themselves and for their families. Cigarette smokers are in worse physical condition than non-smokers in general. Cigarette smokers generally have lower incomes and less formal education. They're more likely to be unemployed or unemployable, and cigarette smokers are more likely to be racial minorities. So in short, paying for children's health care through a cigarette tax is very regressive, targeting the less educated, the lower income, the sicker, and minority Oregonians. Yet you're considering a bill that will tax those very people to provide a subsidy for insurance for families that are earning up to at least $70,000.
Madam, or Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
May I ask a question here?
Please.
Or would you like?
I'd be delighted to have you ask a question.
Thank you. Good afternoon to you.
Okay.
Do you have data that support the 6 points that you just made?
Yes, Senator, I can get that to you later. I don't have it right here with me, but it's not specifically Oregon data. It's national data.
I was just going to ask if it was Oregon
right.
data. Which
some of it is Oregon data, but some of it is national data.
I would be interested in the Oregon data, which would be more relevant.
I've been looking for that.
On the
I found it for other individual states and for the nation, but I've only found part of it for Oregon. And some of the administrators in the programs here may have that data, but I haven't been able to locate all the specifics.
Which of the six statements is supported by Oregon data?
I would have to get back to you on that. I don't have it right here in front of me.
Okay.
But I will get that for you. I'll get it for the whole committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in reading those 6 points, would it be safe to say that the children of the very populations you're describing are also probably the ones who will be most helped by this, given the demographics you're describing?
It could be, yes, if they take it up on it. That's another issue of the 95% take-up rate I would question, but I think that's a separate issue.
Okay.
So I think the bottom line on this point about taxing smokers to provide health insurance for children is that taxing smokers will make the ship, or could make the ship, sink faster, because it will be harder for them, for the smoking families, to afford health care for themselves, at least for the adults. Second, the proposed tax increase almost certainly won't generate the revenue that is hoped for at least two reasons. Oregon saw more black market and internet cigarette purchases when taxes were increased in the past. A big new tax increase will accelerate this trend, or could accelerate this trend, leaving revenue below estimates. And I know the estimate is supposedly adjusted for this, but I would question whether those estimates are accurate. If Oregon raises the cigarette tax up to the level of Washington State, which, as I understand it, is the stated goal of this bill, you'll lose tens of millions of dollars in already existing tax revenue, and you lose a big chunk of the revenue that you were counting on as Washingtonians stopped buying cigarettes in Oregon. We saw a big increase recently when Washington's tax was raised. I think that will go away with, you know, if you go to tax equalization. So the bottom line on that point, as far as the Dr. Kitzhaber's health care ship, is that the program will cause one more financial hole in the state of Oregon's budget, which, and this may be a bad analogy, but is like another iceberg hitting the Titanic of some size. The third problem with the program that I see is that offering free insurance to a new group, and when I say free, I'm talking about the below 200% of poverty, no premiums, to a new group will put upward pressure on the cost of insurance and health care for everyone else in the state. Offering people something for free is generally a prescription for misuse or overuse, And with no fiscal discipline, the Healthy Kids families may tend to make choices that would put even more pressure on the system. Granted, they may make some choices that would put less pressure on the system, like they may visit emergency rooms less than they do now for primary care. But I think there will be unanticipated other uses or overuses of the system that may not be accounted for in the assumptions of this bill. Also, why should we assume that families up to 200% of the poverty level can't afford to pay even $1 for their health care, for their health insurance premiums? As I understand the bill, premiums only start above, or a portion of the premium only starts above the 200% of poverty level. Well, the number of Oregon health plan members did drop coverage rather than pay, as I understand it, a $5 monthly copay in the past. I think we might have learned the wrong lesson from that situation. Rather than assume that those Oregon health plan patients couldn't afford to pay even a modest amount for their health care, we should assume, or we might assume, that they simply valued other goods and services more than they valued the insurance that was offered to them under the plan. They'd take the insurance if it was free, but wouldn't bother if the price was anything above zero. There are hundreds of families in the Portland area earning less than 185% of the poverty level who contribute $500 a year, or have contributed $500 a year or more to match private scholarships for their children that are facilitated by Cascade Policy Institute and what's called the Children's Scholarship Fund. And those families are in the same, basically the same demographic that you're talking about for the Healthy Kids program. That's 200% of poverty or below for zero premium. These families were 185% or below. The $500 or more they're paying per year is to buy a service that's on top of the free public education that they could have gotten or were getting for their children in public schools. But they chose to pay $500 to, in some cases, several thousand dollars a year because they valued the product or the service they were getting, in this case, a different education for their children. So I think we need to ask ourselves why Oregon Health Plan members didn't, and potentially Healthy Kids program families might not, value health care services being offered at least enough to pay something for them, even if they're at 200% or below of the poverty level. The fourth problem I see with the Healthy Kids program is that it will offer insurance covering regular routine care in addition to catastrophic care. This perpetuates what I believe are the perverse incentives in our current health insurance system. This coverage of routine care through the health insurance system that is part of the reason why health care is so expensive in the first place. Most of what we call health insurance today is not really insurance at all. It's simply prepayment for routine services like checkups and lab work. The proper function of an insurance market, is to protect us from events that are expensive, that are relatively unpredictable, and that are relatively rare. We pool our money and spread the financial risk of catastrophic events, and we all hope that we're never going to have a claim. In short, health insurance should look more like our auto insurance or more like our homeowner's insurance, where it covers catastrophic care, not daily maintenance. And I would ask you to consider, why doesn't our car insurance, for example, cover fill-ups at the gas station or oil changes? Gas would be free in that case, but your car insurance premiums would go through the roof. And the price of the products of maintaining your car would go up also because of what we know is called the third-party payer problem. Someone else is paying the bill, or you assume it is, so you overuse the product or the price goes up. We have a third-party payer problem in health care already, and I'm afraid that the Healthy Kids program would simply make that problem worse. The program assumes a maximum cost, which may turn into a minimum cost as some of these programs go. It assumes a monthly cost of $160 per child for health insurance. It would be fully subsidized by the state at below 200% of poverty. As I understand it, over 350%, the family would pay the full $160 cost per child. But I think that number tells us something. The Wall Street Journal on Tuesday pointed out that the soon-to-be mandated plan in Massachusetts that we've all heard about might start at what they call a whopping $380 per month for an individual, where in nearby Connecticut, with fewer health insurance regulations, a 35-year-old man can get covered for as little as $50 a month. So $50 a month in Connecticut for an adult versus $160 a month for a child in Oregon. It's that high.
Begin to wrap it up, please.
Okay. It's that high cost that causes many families to forego health insurance for their children in the first place. I think in terms of, I just want to give you quickly some alternatives, because I agree with Representative Richardson and I'm sure all the others who stated it, that we want every child in Oregon to have health care, to have access to health care. I think one of the ways to do, or a couple of the ways to do that would be to look at how we can move the insurance system in Oregon to a more of a truly insurance system instead of a prepayment for health care. We can do that through emphasizing health savings accounts, which are already in federal law. Every federal employee in Oregon has a choice of multiple HSAs to choose from. You could be instrumental in allowing Oregon state employees, public employees, to have health savings accounts. You can also be instrumental in doing what is starting now as a test program called health opportunity accounts that the federal government just authorized as of January 1st, that allows states to take Medicaid money and pre-fund the savings, the tax-free savings account, in a health savings account. So even the Medicaid population could have a health savings account. And then you'd be in a position where I think the incentives, the financial incentives, would more closely match what you're looking for. A child gets sick with a cold, for example. Today, with no insurance, they may end up in the emergency room, as we all know. If they have insurance, they may go to their doctor, which would cost the system, say, $85. But if they had a $100 health savings account, they may decide that instead of going to the doctor, they buy Sudafed at the pharmacy for, I don't know what the price is, $6 or something, and save and have the other $94 that they save in their health savings account.
Actually,
it changes the
incentive.
Excuse me?
So they won't be able to buy Sudafed at the
I don't know the price. It's a lot less than $85. Mm-hmm. In other words, the Oregon Health Plan, as I understand it, doesn't cover common cold because it gets better by itself. There's not much the doctor can do. But if the health insurance is free, there's a tendency to use that in still a very expensive way, not as expensive as an emergency room, but when you have money in the bank that is pre-funded from the state through Medicaid dollars, I think it changes the financial incentive. So if you could start moving those two populations, public employees in Oregon and people on the Oregon Health Plan, low income or Medicaid patients, to a health savings type or health opportunity type account, I think you'd see more of a change in behavior than all the marketing that the Healthy Kids Plan could do. And that would be a win for the kids, it would be a win for taxpayers, and it would be a win for, I think, all Oregonians. And thank you for listening, and I'll take any further questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you. And Senator Gordon, I will get you that where that data comes from.
And I'd like you, with the consent of the chair, to make that available to the entire committee.
Thank you. I will.
Okay. We really need to move quickly now. I'll ask you all to hold your presentations to 3 minutes. I'll try and keep you there. I think we're not going to be done by 4, but we will definitely be done by 4:15. Deborah Loy, Cindy Becker, and Nicola Pinson. Are you guys here? Okay. No? Yes? Yes. Here we go. Where'd the guy in the middle come from?
Chair Greenlick, Chair Monis Anderson, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicola Pinson. I'm legal counsel to the Oregon Primary Care Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Oregon's community health centers agree that the Healthy Kids legislation is a critical step in expanding coverage to the over 100,000 uninsured children in Oregon. We support this expansion, and we see it as a building block to expanding coverage for Oregon's uninsured. We urge you and all of our colleagues to continue this work to extend coverage to the adults who remain uninsured, particularly the 80,000 adults who've lost coverage under the Oregon Health Plan in the last couple of years. As you know, a lack of parental coverage remains a significant barrier in achieving full coverage for kids. Adult coverage is therefore an essential or necessary step to achieving the goals of this legislation. In addition to expanding the income eligibility, this legislation, the Healthy Kids Program, makes several important improvements to the eligibility and enrollment procedures of the Oregon Health Plan, including one-year continuous eligibility, simplified application procedures, and enhanced outreach efforts. As you know, the 60,000 children, or more than half of the uninsured children in Oregon, are already eligible for existing coverage. The outreach and eligibility features of the proposed bill would go far in removing barriers for coverage for this population. One area of concern for us with the Healthy Kids structure is regarding the continuity of patient-provider relationships for children with income levels fluctuating above and below 200% of the poverty level. With the addition of the private health option created by this legislation for families earning above 200% of the federal poverty level, we are very concerned that this structure could create barriers for continuity of care and the patient-provider relationship, where there is a new set of plans and provider panels in addition to the set of plans and provider panels under the Oregon Health Plan. With children especially, this kind of structure may result in splitting where families are able to access care. For example, parents and children that may have an established relationship with a safety net provider, but then this relationship may become disrupted when incomes fluctuate slightly above 200% of the poverty level, and children may be forced to seek care through other or a different set of providers.
Give one more minute.
While most of our patients fall below the federal poverty level, we do have a number of uninsured or serve a substantial number of uninsured children with incomes at or around 200% of the federal poverty level. If they happen to have incomes at 205% of the poverty level, as an example, we want them to have the choice to remain with their safety net provider. To be clear, we are not requesting that safety net providers be the only providers on contract, but that patients have the choice to continue their coverage or care through safety net providers. We urge you to consider directing the Office of Private Health Partnerships to include language in their request for proposals that directs plans to successfully maintain a patient-provider relationship by assuring children have the choice to remain with their safety net provider when shifting coverage to the private health option.
Thank you very much. We have your written testimony on that. Appreciate your comment. Okay.
Sir, for my good looks, Mr. Chairman.
Somebody. All right.
Can we vote on that?
We didn't bring your horn with you today.
Mr. Chair, can I make one quick comment?
Please.
I think you're raising some very valid points. I think one of the reasons with the 12-month enrollment will help with some of that income fluctuation. I think that was an issue with the 6-month. So hopefully it's some of that income jumping. But I think that request to look at it in the RFP is certainly a valid one. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and also I do believe that the Oregon Health Policy and Research is going to be looking and evaluating data, and hopefully they will be looking at that piece also to make sure if that is happening, then hopefully by rule or whatever, we will be able to take care of those situations. It's on record.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair. My concern is also about access, that when we balloon the numbers in my community of Grants Pass, that the number of pediatricians there is limited, and the wait times to get into these pediatricians, whether it's, you know, just your standard family practice, pediatric office, or in the safety net clinic, SISPU in our case, those wait times are long already, and we don't have the providers in the community. Well aware of it personally, that we do not have providers in the community to fill that need today with what we've got. And so I just am, you know, going back is that concern about the access and providers, which addresses a lot of other issues that we need to discuss further. But I still have grave concerns about access once we enroll children.
Thank you.
And follow up on that, because that is a grave concern, and there is legislation there. We're not sure it's going to get through the process, but hopefully it's going to get through the process in the next session or two regarding access and expanding the sites of say kids clinics and things like that. So, you know, it's it's a long process, and this is the first little step, as I see it.
Thank you. Cindy?
Thanks. Chair Greenlick, Chair Montes-Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Becker, and I am the new executive director of COHO, which is the Coalition for Healthy Oregon. First, I'd like to tell you that COHO supports Senate Bill 31 and House Bill 2201, and we applaud this effort to provide health insurance to all Oregon children. There currently are 11 community-based managed care plans that are members of COHO, and they serve more than 265,000 individuals across the state. And children comprise about 60% of the enrollees, about 158,000. With this experience in mind, COHO has 3 points to make. First and foremost is, while coverage of children is very critical in this health system, COHO will continue to advocate for coverage of families. We really believe, through research and our own experience, that covering the parents is going to make it much more likely that children will access and enroll in health care. The second issue is around access and enrollment. The fact that was pointed out by Representative Richardson and talked about by Dr. Goldberg is there are currently about 60,000 children who are currently eligible today, as we sit here, they're eligible for enrollment, and they have not enrolled. And Dr. Goldberg talked about a variety of reasons, but I think it's very important that the outreach efforts really not be very general, that they have to get down to one-on-one discussions with families. Last year, I was involved in the Medicare the Part D, the prescription drug program, and trying to educate seniors across the state about this program and actually getting them to involve that enrollment really took a lot of one-on-one counseling. Department of Human Services and others know about that. I think the same is true here, that just saying that this program is available isn't going to be enough. By getting posters out isn't going to be enough. There really has to be that one-on-one conversation. Many of these families have never had health insurance. They're not used to this system. They may not want to be involved with the state. It's really going to involve a lot different outreach than I think that we've seen in the past. 1 minute. Okay. Last but not least, COHO would also like to suggest to you that rather than setting up another administrative system, that you already have a system in place, as Dr. Goldberg mentioned, OHP, that serves many, many clients across the state and could also has the infrastructure, has the capacity in the community, there's delivery systems in the community with the managed care plans, and rather than setting up a whole administrative structure separate from OHP, that we use OHP actually to be the infrastructure for the health insurance program. With that, thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you all very much. Tom Chamberman, David Laura, and Andy Miller.
Chair Montes-Anderson, Chair Greenlick, and committee members. My name is Andy Miller, Senior Policy Analyst for the Oregon Business Association. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about the Healthy Kids program. Providing sustainable health care for all Oregonians through balanced solutions involving individuals, businesses, medical providers, public policies, and educational programs that improve access and affordability is of paramount importance to our citizens, business, and economy. The Oregon Business Association is seeking an affordable system of public health that emphasizes healthy lifestyles and illness prevention, with access to medical care when necessary, with public expenditures for medical care cost-effectively allocated. Preventative services are the key to controlling much more costly health care services when minor conditions are left untreated. OBA believes it's in the business community's best interest to have a strong public sector health program. Specifically, OBA supports providing preventative services to uninsured children. The Healthy Kids program will make children's health care coverage affordable for all Oregon families. Children without health care are less likely to be successful academically. We owe it to our state's children to give them the best possible foundation for success in school. The Healthy Kids program will provide access to basic health care services such as eyeglasses, asthma inhalers, and medicine. Just as we view adequate funding for schools as investment, we view providing access to health care as an investment. By providing health care to children today, Oregon will have a healthier and less costly tomorrow. OBA supports access to basic health care for all Oregonians and will consider all serious proposals based on sound business principles. This program is a good first step towards comprehensive health care reform. Thank you.
Andy, thank you very much. Any questions? Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenleaf, Vice Chair Richardson, and oh, there's so many vice chairs and vice chairs.
A whole bunch of us.
Yes. I just want to thank you for all the efforts that you've taken and congratulate you on all the great work that you've been doing regarding this problem that has reached crisis proportion. And I was really impressed when the Democrats met at the summit in Sun River. I don't know if any Republicans sneaked in to see what we were doing. But anyway, it was amazing how Governor Kitzhaber, Representative Greenleaf, and I think Dr. Bates was there too, and how they got their ideas together. And then finally, it looks like we're getting something done. But I have a few concerns that I guess I could just turn it into suggestions. And some of the speakers have mentioned some of the concerns too that I would probably repeat here. And the first one is under suggestions is A, please do not include co-payments as part of the funding for this health program.
Excuse me, would you please introduce yourself for the
record? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm David Loera, and I'm a citizen of Salem.
Thank you.
For the last, say, 30 years. And the Oregon Health Plan, or OHP, lost thousands of recipients due to this requirement. And I don't have those numbers, you know, to substantiate that statement. And B, please be inclusive and compassionate. Do not deny services to recipients due to their documentation or lack of status. And C, Governor Ted Kulongoski should find a stronger source of funding for his Healthy Kids plan. The cigarette tax is too shaky and unreliable, and this has been tried many times before. Back about 15 years when I was working with the alcohol and drug program, this proposal was tried to fund the alcohol program and the mental health program, and it did not work. Just like the sales tax, it does not pass, you know, and it is again, we're taxing a very vulnerable a section of the population, you know, and it's not, again, it's not reliable. Other than that, I congratulate you for the fine work that you're doing, and thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Chair Monis Anderson, Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee. My name is Tom Chamberlain, and I'm president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. It's unbelievable to me that 117,000 kids don't have health care. And I think even more shocking is that 91% of those kids live in working families. Working families who 15 or 20 years ago would have had health care, would have had jobs that provided health care. You see, we had an American value back then. That is, if you work hard, you played by the rules, you would get a family wage job, health care, and a decent retirement. But you know, all that's changed. We've lost 68,000 jobs in Oregon alone since the passage of NAFTA. And that value, that of hard work, is disappearing as quickly as the middle class is disappearing in this country. You know, I was a firefighter for 27 years in the city of Portland. And as a fire, as you could guess, I was placed in many dangerous situations, and there were times I was frightened, and there's times I should have been frightened, and I wasn't. But You know, there is nothing as frightening to me as things I face as a parent. And the welfare of your children, and if you can't provide an income that's going to protect them, that's the type of fear that keeps you up at night. That's the type of fear that haunts you during your waking hours, and that's the type of fear that causes you to work two jobs and work as much overtime as you can have to have to provide for your children. You know, when working families have to make a choice between medical treatment and medicine and food, that's a choice they shouldn't have to make. I don't know if any of you... Yes, this is very embarrassing.
Everybody else, show off your phones.
And I was just getting to the good stuff. I don't know if any of you have an ailment like asthma. I do. And you know, if you are frightened about where your next breath is coming from, I just can't explain to you what that's like. And if you have asthma, you have one of these. And when I think about the Healthy Kids bill, I think about those children that don't have one of these. And I think about when their condition becomes acute and their parents race them to the hospital and they're so frightened and that child really doesn't know what's going on. And I'll tell you, when they get to the hospital, the treatment is more intrusive and it's more expensive. You know, we live in this pioneer state, and we have a strong sense of community about taking care of each other. That's what I think this bill's about, is taking care of each other. We really ask your support for this bill. It's the right thing to do.
Tom, thank you very much. Any questions? Sorry it took so long to get you on. All of you, and all of the others who've waited. Can we have Kevin Finney, Laura Etherton, and would staff try and get Ellen Pinney on the phone, please?
Yeah, it's working. Yes, it works.
Chair Montes-Anderson, Chair Greenlich, members of both committees, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Thank you for your hard work and leadership on this issue. I'm Kevin Finney, the Public Policy Director with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, an association of 17 Christian denominations, many congregations, social ministries, and interreligious organizations. Today I want to briefly touch on the primary reasons Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon supports this legislation, and I'll try and paraphrase much of my written testimony. Basically, we support this because we believe it's consistent with the deepest moral principles of the Judeo-Christian tradition to care for the most vulnerable in our society. We also believe it's solid, well-thought-out public policy. We believe it's solid, well-thought-out public policy for many of the reasons you've already heard today. It's leveraging of state funds to make maximum use of federal funding. It's reliance or increased use of preventive care and primary care to avoid illnesses becoming more serious and costly. It's use of co-pays and cost-sharing for families that can afford it. Funding and administrative direction given for outreach and enrollment programs, coupled with reduced barriers to enrollment and simplification of enrollment procedures. We believe this is just smart thinking and, frankly, something not always seen in government programs. And we also believe that utilizing the tobacco tax increase to provide for funding this program, that in doing so, this legislation has not only found a reasonable mechanism to fund a worthy goal, but has selected a mechanism that will in itself have additional health benefits and reduce the health costs we all must share. Critics of this legislation have argued that the tobacco tax mechanism is not the best choice. One reason given is that it's unstable and may lead to a decline in revenues as a result of reducing cigarette use. We feel confident that the revenue projections adequately account for any change in revenue due to a decrease in smoking rates. And we understand that they not only have taken into account reductions in revenue from reduced cigarette sales as a result of this tax, but also as a result of taking into account other programs, anti-smoking programs that are ongoing or new programs that the governor is proposing. So our understanding is these revenue figures should be solid through June of 2011 and maybe beyond that. There may be a need in the future to find supplemental funding, and we hope your committee and others in the legislature will plan for this, but we do not believe future revenue issues should slow down passage of this legislation before you today. Another concern some have raised...
Wrap it up, please.
You
wrap it up, please.
Yeah. I just also want to say that some have objected that the tobacco tax asks smokers as a group to fund a program of universal benefit and thus is not fair. We're on record, our organization, as favoring a tax system that is fair, progressive, and provides sufficient revenue for all state programs. I think it's a mistake, however, to expect that individual taxes should fall evenly on all members of our state. That approach would unduly hamper government in building the revenue base necessary to carry out important state programs like the Healthy Kids Program. We support inclusive application of this program, and we think that you should recognize that many faiths have a long-term concern with health care. And that when you extend this coverage to 117,000 children in Oregon, you're really saying to them not only that they live in a just community that won't turn their backs on their health care needs, but also you're saying to them, you are special and precious in our eyes, and we look upon your life with an attitude of loving concern for your health and well-being. Isn't that what we should say to all our children? Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. Questions? Laura?
Hey there. Thank you, Chair Monis-Anderson and Chair Greenlick and members of both committees for the opportunity to testify in support of the Oregon Healthy Kids Plan. My name is Laura Etherton, and I'm the Consumer Advocate for Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. OSPIRG's a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest advocate here in Oregon. I will keep my comments very brief today. Oregonians across the state are facing sharply rising health care costs, from skyrocketing drug costs to ever-rising insurance premiums, copays, and coinsurance. OSPIRG supports reforms to reduce costs and improve quality and accountability. We applaud the work of both of these committees and those around the state who are working to bring forward this first step toward a solution, making quality, affordable health care for children available to all Oregon families. It is outrageous that nearly 118,000 Oregon children go without health care, without health insurance. Most insured children live in families where at least one parent works, but steeply rising insurance costs put coverage out of reach. We've heard time and time again how children without health insurance are more likely to end up in the emergency room. I'd like to emphasize again that this is terrible for the quality of care for these children, and it ends up driving costs for everyone. It is penny wise and pound foolish. Experts estimate health insurance premiums are about 10% higher due to costly emergency care for the uninsured. The Healthy Kids Program will give every child access to quality, affordable health care by securing new federal funds for the Oregon Health Plan, as well as by pooling purchasing power to make affordable quality care available on a sliding scale to families across the state. It simply makes sense to guarantee access to preventative care, checkups, and other effective treatments for children. And it makes sense to update and raise Oregon's tobacco tax in order to fund it. It makes sense to discourage young people from smoking. It's estimated that with the increase in the tobacco tax proposed here, 29,400 children alive today will not take up smoking. Ultimately, that means over 9,000 of them will not experience a premature death due to smoking. That is a significant thing that we can do to make sure that this next generation is the healthiest generation of Oregon children ever. Senator Monis Anderson and Representative Greenlick, we applaud your leadership on this critical issue. Thank you for advancing this SMART plan to make sure Oregon children gain access to the care they need. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Yeah, you want to try that phone once more while we call Carol Rahm and Martin and Kelly Taylor?
Not husband and wife.
Not even brother and sister.
Or cousin.
Cheers, Greenlight.
Maybe we do have a hit here.
Hello?
Ellen?
Yes.
Hi, this is Mitch Greenlick. You're on and you have 3 minutes.
Thank you. I've been listening to the testimony. For the record, I thank you for letting me be here. For the record, my name is Ellen Pinney. I'm the health policy advocate for the Oregon Health Action Campaign. I believe you have copies of my written testimony, and you'll be glad to know that it's not my intent to read it for the record. You should know that I'm at a Families USA healthcare conference in Washington, D.C., where our own Senator Gordon Smith got honored yesterday in front of the 700 participants for his work to save Medicaid and CHIP, and he renewed his commitment to making sure that CHIP, the money that we need to adequately fund this expansion, is not only reauthorized but expanded, so we can capture that 60% of uninsured eligible children who are not now enrolled. I want to offer great thanks to all of you who made this possible. 2201 is a great first step along the road to universal coverage, and it is to be applauded for many things that I've listed, but I want to specifically point out reducing the uninsurance waiting requirement, prohibiting the practice in kids' coverage of imposing delays for pre-existing conditions, requiring the development of a streamlined application process, including a revenue stream, and providing a premium subsidy for families up to 350% of the poverty level. I want to emphasize that numerous studies have shown over and over that families with incomes less than 200% of the poverty level virtually have no disposable income, and that if we can give them policy, that if we, families should be prevented from having to drop coverage when their income changes. And this bill will help make that happen. Finally, it's great that this bill puts in place a one-stop eligibility determination process. Our major concern about 2201 is that kind of cliff that happens at 200% of federal poverty level. Below 200% of federal poverty level, you're on the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid. Above 200%, you may be required to choose a new plan with a whole new set of providers. This has a great potential for disrupting provider-patient relationships, which are particularly important for families of children with special needs. There are three things that can be done to address this problem. Allow families
and
the
you've got 30 seconds to talk about them.
I'm sorry?
You have 30 seconds to name the three things.
Allow families to buy into the plan, require Medicaid benefits to wrap around private market benefits for children with special needs, and adopt patients of the provisions of the Patient Protection Act that require continuity of coverage, our provider-patient relationships for patients who are in the middle of a course of treatment like pregnancy. You have our other recommendations in front of you, and I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Ellen.
Now, let me ask you just a brief question. Do you think some of those three can be done by administrative rule?
I think particularly the third recommendation can be done by administrative rule. I believe that Representative Gelser is working on proposals that might allow for the first two proposals.
Great. Ellen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ellen.
Carol?
For the record, my name is Carol Rahm, and I'm the co-chair of the Medicaid Advisory Committee. And Senator Chair Montes-Anderson, Chair Greenlick, members of the committees, I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today on this very, very important proposal for Oregon's children and Oregon's future. And I want to, you've heard a lot of testimony on Wednesday and today, and today I want to just speak on behalf of the people that we talk to through the process of the Medicaid Advisory Committee, and that includes hundreds of advocates, providers, business owners, union leaders, and just members of the general Greater Oregon community. And these folks were very helpful to us in presenting testimony, talking to us, and informing our recommendations and report to the governor on healthy kids. And from these discussions, we learned three things about the problem of uninsurance with children in Oregon. First is that there isn't availability of coverage, and you've heard stories about this in the last couple of sessions here, but basically folks who are not eligible for the Oregon Health Plan or do not have employer-sponsored health coverage available to them are the people who are falling through the cracks here. The second issue is that of affordability. People may be offered insurance but unable to pay for it. And the third is that it's just darn confusing. Healthcare has become more and more complex, and except for some of the policy wonks in this room, it's probably really difficult for parents who are trying to make responsible decisions about their children to understand the myriad of rules and regulations. So we support House Bill 2201 and Senate Bill 31 for four reasons. First, healthy kids will cover hopefully about 117,000 uninsured Oregon children. That's a wonderful thing. Second, it will make insurance available to all uninsured children despite their income level. And so we've had discussions here about how people can buy in. Even if they exceed the income levels for subsidy, they'll be able to buy into a good insurance product. Third, we applaud the outreach and simplification and the no wrong door approach. And fourth, we believe that this legislation is a first step towards providing affordable health insurance to all Oregonians. And, Governor Kitzhaber's name was brought up here, and I listened to him last week talk about the sinking ship and the children. And yes, Healthy Kids is a lifeboat, a very needed lifeboat, and yes, the ship is sinking. But I think it will demonstrate for everyone that we can do it and give us the mechanisms to do it. We had a couple of concerns about the bill. I see Representative looking at me, so I'm going to pass over them and just thank you. they've been actually addressed today, so I'm not going to.
I always get such good action when I
wait. Yeah. But I want to thank you for your work on this and let you know that the Medicaid Advisory Committee stands prepared to support you in your work towards health reform.
Thank you.
Thank you for your work.
The Taylor team.
Thank you for having us today. My name is Kelly Ray Taylor. I'm the chair of the Cabinet on Health Policy for the Oregon Nurses Association. I'm also a full-time nurse in Portland in the hospital setting. I'm going to be brief. You have a written testimony in front of you, which you can refer to if you want to read further into our suggestions. Senate Bill 31 and House Bill 2201 are each complete ideas within themselves and can do much good without being changed or amended. However, ONA has a checklist of additional steps that we ask you to consider either as amendments to these bills or as amendments to future bills or as a subsequent health care for all kids bill later this session. First is the idea of a primary care home. In ONA's proposal, we call these kids clinic networks. Nurses believe that our existing health care delivery system is based on an insurance reimbursement system that rewards treating acute illness yet often fails to support the continuum of services that leads to real health, including preventive care, primary care, and case management. Rather than only expanding the existing delivery system for children, we should consider transitioning to a health care delivery system that follows a primary care home model, also known as medical homes, in order to actually improve the health of our kids rather than focusing on curing acute illness. Suggestion number two, point of contact health delivery. We should direct insurance reimbursement to providers who are most easily accessible to children. A child cannot be expected to understand insurance coverage, to seek out a provider, or to navigate a benefit package. What a child can do is seek out a school-based health center or receive a home visit from a public health nurse. We should be growing a payment system that supports healthcare providers who are already at the point of contact with children rather than expanding the currently disjointed and not easily navigated insurance system by just making a new provider network that is just as difficult for a child to access as the old network. Today, more than half of our uninsured children already qualify for the Oregon Health Plan, and parents who are uninsured are unlikely to utilize the health care insurance of their children. It is predictable that many parents will continue to underutilize health care for their children if we stay within the same health care delivery framework. Suggestion number three, medical records. There should be a single system of tracking the medical records of children in Oregon. One could argue that, as adults, we should have the responsibility to transfer our medical records when we move between providers or healthcare systems. Children, however, particularly those in unstable situations, need to have a healthcare provider network that can keep up with their previous medical history and treatments. Children who live in multiple households or who are homeless, children with unreliable parents, or children who mask their health status from parents, such as those with eating disorders, mental health conditions, drug use, etc., need a more responsive system in place. And last, a nurse advice line. In Oregon, we have two statewide health care advice lines, the Poison Center and the Quit Line for Smokers. ONLY suggests that we should develop a statewide nurse advice line for children as well. This has several advantages. First, advice lines allow families to take care of many health needs at home without ever visiting a provider.
Excuse me, Ms. Taylor.
Yes.
Are you going to talk to me?
Yes.
Okay, then, please wrap it up.
I'm in the last sentence. Second, advice lines can direct patients to the proper care setting, reducing unnecessary visits to the emergency room. Third, children of some age can access the advice line themselves.
Thank you very much. I look forward, as do others, I'm working with you on those items, even if it doesn't work in this field. They are very important items.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, Chair Moss Anderson. For the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here representing the Oregon Nurses Association. And let me start simply by thanking you for extending the public testimony period as long as you have. I know you've tested your patience and you're all chomping at the bit to argue and come up with the final product, and we're holding you back. But this is a great committee. You've been great listeners. You've asked tremendous questions, and I think that you've done justice to a complicated proposal. If you had done less than ask those questions, you wouldn't have been doing your jobs, and I appreciate that. I would also say that Kelly's written testimony includes a lot of additional ideas, and I hope you take a chance to read that written testimony. It was well thought through and prepared by her. And finally, while we've recognized the hard work of Representative Kotek and the Chair Monis Anderson and the Governor on this, we often don't recognize the people who really helped us access this process: Rick Bercobian, Aaron Kelly Seal, Bruce Goldberg. Those were all folks who have as much to do this proposal as anyone, and I would like to make sure that they're also acknowledged. I'll make my comments very quick. I've dumped most of what I wanted to say, but this is, I think, the thing that is the most true of ONA. We do not look at this bill as an additional program. We look at this as a building block towards universal health care. The question keeps coming up, why provide a new entitlement to folks with $70,000 or $90,000 incomes? And the answer is, this is like asking the question, why provide a public education for someone with $70,000 or $90,000 income, or a fire district or a police district? That the commitment to making sure that people have health care is a commitment similar to education or public safety or roads. And we're not looking at this as a program. We're looking at this as a first step towards building a delivery system for health care that is effective for Oregonians, it's cost-effective, and it makes sense. And what you do for kids is what you ought to want to plan to do for everybody else. And that is a much more difficult concept to get your minds around when you're dealing with a specific bill. And I have to admit, a year ago we thought this moment would be an apex in building something onto the existing delivery system, and now we've become more ambitious. We actually believe that what you've got now isn't an apex, it's actually a starting point. And it's a starting point towards something that could be really remarkable in the state, and you have a political climate and political leaders that can take us in that direction. Our hope this session is that this doesn't become the intellectual property of John Kitzhaber or Ted Kulongoski or Mitch Greenlick or Lamont Anderson or Bates and Westland. It's the intellectual property of the state legislature, all of you, Democrats and Republicans. We don't get there otherwise. And it's not a fight over the tobacco tax, and it's not a fight over health care for kids. It's a discussion on how do we eventually take care of the fundamental problems in our society around cost shifting and perverse incentives and an insurance system that is covering the wrong things and move towards something like a primary care home. And that's really not the conversation you're having here, because you're focusing on a tree. There's a forest out there. And this is a bellwether issue. If we can't do this for kids, if we can't overcome this obstacle, you're really nipping in the bud a much bigger and more important conversation about how do we do this for everybody, and shouldn't we do this for everybody. We can make this a political football, or we can make this a moment where we rose above that kind of politics and said we do have an opportunity that maybe comes once every 20 years, to do something really remarkable around healthcare, and it's going to require working as a group of Oregonians and not as a group of lawmakers, not as a group of Democrats and Republicans. And I hope we get to that point in the conversation, because at that point in the conversation, I think ONA has some unique things to contribute, and you have an opportunity to do for Oregonians something that could be really the first in the country and really something special.
All right, thank you very much. I really second what you just said. Let's keep moving so we can get to work. Thank you very much. We have two more panels that we're going to try and do. I was wrong about even 4:15. Otto Schell, and is Tim Nesbitt in the room? Okay.
A panel of one.
No, one more panel.
Good afternoon. I will be brief. I won't just tell you I'll be brief. I'm Otto Schell. I'm the Vice President for Legislation with the Oregon PTA. I'm here as a parent and as a volunteer. I come down here a lot. I hear a lot of people talking about important issues, but this is a really important issue. And I thought, how long has PTA been paying attention to this kind of issue? How long have we been talking about this issue? And I found a book that was written the year that I was born. It's the 50-year history of the Oregon PTA. They were talking about it then. We're still talking about it now. The other frame of reference is I found in our national history, Teddy Roosevelt was still governor in New York when they were talking about health care for kids. So we have a real important opportunity here. I think Oregon can be a leader. I have a little packet of written material that points out some dates when Oregon did things, like in 1933, it sponsored the Oregon Rural Health Bill. In 1937, it started TB tests and allocated money for rural kids to have access to preventive care. These are all in this wonderful little book, and I'll give a copy to you. In the 1940s, they provided back-to-school health care for kids at the community level because there was a shortage of doctors and nurses, and they used the schools and the PTAs to get that organized. So you stand on the same shoulders of many legislators who acted in that time frame. I stand on the shoulders of the parents who came to talk to them. I hope that we'll be able to actually do something about this. And I'll be here to help you and encourage you on doing that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
For your testimony and for being brief.
You bet.
One last panel. Michael Becker, Susan Rasmussen, and Deborah Loy.
And while they're getting up here, I think this needs to be noted for the record that we have testimony presented to us in writing from Ives Lafrane, a family practice physician, from the City Club of Portland, a letter from Julie Young from the Early Childhood Advocacy Committee Chair, as well as from the Oregon Chapter National Association of Social Workers, Mark McKechnie, and the Oregon Hunger Relief. No, we already had that. Okay, thank you. I did what I was supposed to do.
Start from one side to the other.
Chairs Monis Anderson and Greenlick and members of the committees. My name is Mike Becker. I'm with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, and I work in the area of public policy. Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon is committed to ensuring that all children in Oregon have the health care services and information they need to lead healthy, productive lives. This is why we support passage of the Oregon Healthy Kids Program. Extending health care access to all children is a critical first step, but real reform will only be accomplished when we create an affordable, sustainable, and accountable health care system built on the foundation of patient-focused competition, patient choice, full transparency of provider quality and cost, and shared responsibility for health and wellness. Regents has a long-standing commitment to providing affordable health care options for children. This is evident in our individual plans, where we offer a rate category for individual children from birth to age 17 at very competitive rates, as well as in our participation as one of two certified carriers with the Office of Private Health Partnerships, offering a children's only plan to eligible small employers. Our commitment to children extends beyond our support of this legislation. The region's charitable giving focus is Healthy Kids, and through this we support numerous programs and organizations in Oregon designed to broaden healthcare access for all children, improve health, and reduce barriers that prevent kids from leading healthy, successful lives. This corporate focus aligns with our support of the Oregon Healthy Kids Program, which will further break down barriers, eliminate health disparities, and provide all Oregon children the care they need. At Regents, we believe that a healthy start is the foundation of a healthy life for every child. We look forward to working with the Office of Private Health Partnerships, with DHS and the other stakeholders to resolve any regulatory details and implement the Healthy Kids Program. And finally, meet the challenge of making sure every child in Oregon has access to affordable health care. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chair Monsanderson, Greenlick, and other members. My name is Susan Rasmussen. I'm here representing Kaiser Permanente Northwest. What I'd like to share with you today is, as you go through decisions regarding the Healthy Kids Program, I wanted to share with you the child health program currently administered through Kaiser Permanente and what we do as outreach to our communities. In collaboration with the Multnomah Educational School District and the Salem School District, the Kaiser Child Health Program was created in 2004. We began with 32 schools and enrolled approximately 1,300 children by last spring. In October 2006, we began offering it to over 100 schools and with children from the ages of 3 through 18. Again, through collaboration with the Multnomah and Salem School Districts, we provide outreach to the families. We work with the participating schools to identify the access to health care. We help determine if they're eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, if they have access to FEOP, if they have access possibly to employer-sponsored plans. If it is determined that they're eligible for the Kaiser Permanente Child Health Program, based on incomes of 250% of the federal poverty level and also no other access to coverage, then we assist those children to enroll within Kaiser. Kaiser Permanente is aggressively seeking the uninsured children of the state of Oregon, and we strongly support the Healthy Kids initiatives and look forward to continued partnership. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Moines Anderson and Chair Greenlit and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak before the committee. My name is Deborah Loy, and I represent Capital Dental Care. We are the largest dental care organization under the Oregon Health Plan and cover 108,000 members, 60% of which are children. We support the Healthy Kids Initiative, and I have written testimony, so I will only hit on a few of those because I would rather direct my further testimonies to some questions that Representative Richardson has queried about the delivery system itself. So I echo Erin Kelly Seal's statement saying that dental disease is the most common disease in children. It is an infectious disease and transmissible disease. It's an important part of overall health care and an important inclusion to this particular outreach to uninsured children. I think Representative Richardson has asked some key questions on what does the dental delivery system or what can the dental delivery system do should we have coverage of significantly more children than we already have. I think some key things need to be addressed in that. Over these last few sessions, we've done a lot to try to educate that oral health is an important part of overall health and not just a luxury item or a cosmetic item. And an important part of what happens to the body is including the health of the mouth, and this would include children's mouth. But baby teeth are not important, which is a barrier that I think that we need to break through. When parents have coverage, they bring their children in for coverage, and that's been already testified, and that would be no different for dental. A few years back, the Oregon Health Plan, due to budgetary constraints, no longer covered cleanings or recall visits every 6 months, but changed that coverage parameter to annually. It makes sense to cover it every 6 months. And in specifics, what our plan is doing is not trying to take the current delivery system and stretch it further, but to look for new capacity and new access. The Oregon Health Sciences University has a reinstated pediatric dentistry program, of which they have now 8 students in that program. They're looking for new patients. In the Grants Pass area, we've recently been contacted by a public health facility wanting to provide care to 12-year-olds and under. So our plan's perspective is to look for new access, not just to stretch the access we have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you all very much. Thank you for your patience hanging in with us this long. Hard to be the last. We didn't get done at 4. We didn't get done at 4:15. But the testimony was very valuable, and we appreciate you all sharing with us. Where do you want to?
I'll stay open with my public hearing because we are not going into work session since we can't.
And we appreciate it if you'll join us in our work session. I will end the public hearing on House Bill 2201 and open a work session on House Bill 2201. Roy Freeman, if you can join us. I think we won't take the time to go through the bill section by section, but I would like you here for a few moments at least, if you will.
Okay.
Hang in.
Should I just, do you just want to ask questions, or you want
to
summarize?
I think we'll do it as a part of the discussion.
Okay.
Okay. Should we take the motion here? Either way.
Did you want her to respond to questions on the bill, or just dive right into the bill?
No, I wanted her to be available for us to ask questions as we do the discussion.
I think it'd be appropriate for you to receive a motion that we didn't have discussion.
I thought we can do it either way. Okay, let's start with a motion.
Whatever you prefer.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2201 with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference and be further referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Kotak moves HB 2201 with a due pass recommendation. The bill to be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference and further referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. It turns out the computer wouldn't allow the entry of 2 referrals, so we are now, for the record, adding Ways and Means after Revenue. And we are now open for discussion of the motion.
Mr. Co-Chair, I would move an amendment to House Bill 2201 in the form of what's referred to as LC 717. It's called House Bill 2201-1.
We have dash 9 amendments available. You can pass them on. Thank you. We will open discussion of that amendment. But before we do, I'd like to ask the council a question. Do you have the dash 9 amendments?
I've seen them. I don't have them.
Would you make one available?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, we have 2 minutes to maybe read.
Sure, but let me ask a question while you're reading, and then we get back to it.
Okay.
And Representative Richardson will describe it. There is an item on page 2, section 13A, that makes me wonder about the germaneness of, is germaneness a word? I think it is. The germaneness of that section, and therefore perhaps the whole set of amendments. Could you comment on the extent to which 13A fits under the relating to clause of the House Bill 2201? We haven't had a chance to talk before, so I'm asking you this off the cuff.
I have to get back to you on that one. It is relating to health, and this refers to reporting people who may not be lawfully residing in the U.S., so my instinct would be to say it's not within the relating clause, but I need to get back to you on that one. Now you're wondering what to do, right?
Well, no, I think I know what to do. You can get back to us by next week, Tom?
Yes.
And I think I'm going to adjourn this work session and call a session of the full committee to meet Wednesday next. We post that to continue the work session Wednesday next at 3 p.m. Sandy, does that work for you? Wednesday next at 3 p.m. and the time of the Access Subcommittee. You can stand up. You don't have to crawl around back there.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I ask you to reconsider?
You can, yes.
I would second that request for reconsideration.
Excuse me? Well, let me tell you my thinking about this. We've already posted something else about that. Huh? Can we modify that?
We can modify times or yes.
Can we create a full committee meeting? So here's the question: can we do it?
Yes.
Okay. What's on my mind is I think it's important. I think this is an important discussion. And if a section of this amendment isn't germane, then I think it might be best to find out if it is or isn't. And if it isn't, to create an amendment that is germane. Perhaps you can comment on that in terms of a legislative council comment, and then we can talk about whether that's what we want to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me the latitude of asking for reconsideration. I have questions for Representative Richardson of how this is germane to improving the health of children in the state, and we have heard a lot of testimony, and I would argue probably many of us on the committee would like to discuss and move on, but I will I'll leave it at that.
Well, let me reserve judgment on that then, and let's move forward. We can still take that action if we decide to, or we can just vote the amendment up or down, depending on our... President Gelder, would you have a comment on that?
Yes, I also would like to continue the hearing today, and the question of whether or not the amendment is germane, perhaps we could discuss the amendment and try that up or down vote, and if it moves forward and the amendment is accepted, then perhaps we could adjourn until Wednesday for further discussion to determine whether or not it's germane. But for today, I think it's worthwhile to have the continue with our discussion.
Do you have an opinion on this one?
Mr. Kocher, I believe that we fairly are clear on what the outcome is going to be, and so we might end up spending a lot of time on an issue that will not be relevant, will be moot at the end of the discussion, so we probably should just go ahead and move forward and let the process not be delayed, but it certainly appears.
I'll comment on that, too. All right, well, let's
Mr.
move.
Chair?
Yes, sir.
May I move? I would propose we move for a five-minute break.
Let's stand down for 5 minutes. Well, let's try and make the 5 minutes 5 minutes. And we'll stand down for 5 minutes. We're standing adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
I would move that. I'd like to withdraw the motion that we amend House Bill 2201 with the -9 amendments and change it to...
Have a new motion.
to have a, and I have a new mission, a new motion.
Is there any barrier to accepting the withdrawal? An objection to it? Mr. Vice Chair withdrawing?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments to House Bill 2201.
Representative Richardson has moved the dash three amendments to House Bill 2201. We'll open the floor for discussion. Senator Richardson.
Dash three amendments to House Bill 2201 are very simple in that they make a couple of changes in wording and essentially add the sentence that says that those children that will be covered by the Healthy Kids Program will be those who are United States citizens or aliens who are lawfully residing in the United States. I'm making this motion because we feel that Oregon residents and Oregon citizens have a right to know that their tax money is being used for those that are legally in this state, and that to do otherwise is essentially to say that American citizenship really doesn't matter, that it doesn't matter if you break the law, that you can come here and have the same benefits that citizens have, and we think that's an inappropriate position for us to pass into law.
Thank you. Turns out I don't have 22-1 in front of me. Sandy, can I get a copy of the bill? Yes. Any discussion? Mr. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Richardson, I had a couple of questions for you. I, like you, share the concerns about the problems that illegal immigration causes for us, and I have significant concern with our federal government's complete failure to address this issue over the past several years. And I know that I, probably like you, have been looking at the immigration reform efforts of other states. And I'm wondering if you're aware of any other states that in their efforts at immigration reform have specifically targeted children as a first step towards addressing that problem.
May I respond?
Please.
Mr. Chair, President Gelder, first of all, we're not targeting children. The goal here is to provide insurance, not necessarily just health care. We have federally qualified health clinics throughout the state that have a substantial number of their patients who are illegal aliens, and they are not asked anything about citizenship. In our area, we have La Clinica de Valle. Well, the choice of that name is not an accident. Roughly 50% of their patients speak Spanish. And so there is presently federally funded and with state participation medical care for those that are illegally in Oregon. We also have the CalWIM program, which is a partnership between federal and state money. It's a citizen alien, waived, emergent. So far, medical. Okay, got it. Calum for short. And it basically says that if you can't prove citizenship and you have an emergency, you can go to a hospital and there will be compensation paid for that treatment. And so we want to assure that all children have medical care. But when we're now confronted with a bill that says, we're not talking about just medical care. We're talking about long-term preventative dental, vision, optical care, and medical care. These are care. This is benefits that many Oregonians who work hard can't even provide for their own children without great sacrifice. But if you just come to Oregon, you'll get that for free. And so that it is something that we feel is not appropriate, and that we should let the federal government, who caused this problem, participate in its solution and not have to use 100% of Oregon taxpayer funds to pay for this care and treatment.
Representative, follow-up, please.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was asking some questions about this and found that about of the 117,000 kids that this program will cover, only about 3,500 kids of that 117,000 might not be eligible for a federal subsidy or federal program, and that of those, only a small percentage would be ineligible because their parents were here illegally or because they were here illegally, and that for the most part it would be that they were legal residents of this country but for whatever reason hadn't yet had the length of time, the length of residency. And I wondered about the cost of administering a program where when a child comes in, you need to distinguish all of those different levels of residency and illegality, and if, given that it's less than 2% of the total population of kids that we're trying to cover, if the cost
inadvertently denying care to children that would be eligible would be too great and favorable to that of perhaps accidentally providing some care to individuals that might not be legally here, especially given that these kids are in our schools and sitting in school next to legal citizens and legal residents who would be eligible for these programs. So I'm just concerned that this would create an expensive administrative burden that would be costly in terms of money, but the human cost of turning away a 10-year-old with an ear infection or a 3-year-old that has a fever and strep throat who by no fault of her own happens to be in Oregon and couldn't speak up when she was 9 months old to say, hey, Mom, I don't want to go with you, that cost is maybe a little too great.
Can I respond? Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair. Representative Gilser, I am so glad you bring that up. First of all, if it's a sore throat and those kinds of problems, they could then go to a federally qualified health clinic and get that taken care of. But the point you bring up is very important. I didn't know the numbers that you referred to, but it is so small that it would not make any sense that we would deprive the thousands of Oregon citizens who have children that would benefit from this bill merely because a few of those that are illegal might have to go to an FQHC rather than have all of the benefits for dental and optical and everything else that are promised here. And so because it is so small, I would hope that you would support this amendment.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
A brief follow-up.
It is Friday afternoon, and this is a very important issue. And I share with you that desire that we have a pressing need here, and I think we can all agree that we need to support this. And if for some reason this bill or this amendment isn't successful, I hope that you'll agree that on the floor, this minuscule part is so small that it's not worth holding up health care for 117,000 children, because as you just said, it's very small and doesn't seem like something worth holding it up for everyone.
Final comment. I'd like to ask a very brief question and then move on.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, the point that you make as far as the coverage is important. It's a very small amount of coverage that's affected here. The difficulty is that by doing this, you're setting a precedent that you can be illegal, come to Oregon. If you have families that have kids with problems, come to Oregon. You'll get your care here, and that we won't be asking you difficult questions that you may be asked elsewhere. And so that precedential value is a real problem. We need to send a message that come to Oregon, be a citizen. Come to Oregon, go through what it takes to become a citizen, and then you'll have the benefits that we provide for all Oregonian children, which are vast.
I'd like to ask you a question. My understanding of the lines 6 through 6 and 7 on the Dash 3 amendments refers to the child who is a U.S. citizen or an alien.
Mr. Chair, I assume that is correct because, the whole bill is talking about benefits for children, and so...
So a child born in Oregon of an illegal alien parents...
That would be a citizen.
They would be a citizen and would be eligible.
Exactly. We're talking about a very small number of people. About every month, Calum pays for between 400 and 400 babies to be born to illegal immigrants or illegal people. And so those babies, the cost is paid for by state and federal funds, and they then immediately become citizens, and so they would not be affected by this small amendment. It's a very small group that would be affected.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Richardson has moved the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2201. Would the clerk please call the roll? Those in favor of the amendment vote aye. Those opposed to the amendment vote no.
Representative Bonaduce.
No.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
No.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Gelser.
No.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kotek?
No.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Greenland?
Chair votes no, and the amendment fails. Vice Chair?
Mr. Chair.
I'm not used to using a gavel.
I would move House Bill 2201-8 amendments.
Representative Richardson has moved the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 2201. Any discussion?
Okay.
Senator Richardson.
To explain this, this is a very small change. It actually is just going to change a number in a couple of places in the bill. Basically, the Healthy Kids Plan is set up so that we provide benefits instead of 180% of federal poverty level up to 200% for children, and then through the Oregon Partnership or the Office of Public Health Partnerships, we would have subsidized premiums for children in families that earn up to 350% of the federal poverty level. In 2008, when this would go into effect, that would mean that families earning in excess of $73,000, if they had four families of four earning up to $73,000 or even a little more than $73,000 would have subsidies toward those premiums. We feel that that is no longer what is desirable for Oregon healthcare. Oregon healthcare, we feel, is to provide government assistance to those families that can't provide it for their own, and that families that can provide it our own have the primary responsibility to see that that's done on their own. And so by moving it from 350% down to 250%, which is what is proposed in this amendment, it would still provide for children up to 200% and then another 50% or another essentially $10,000 more for families have children that could be qualified. So that would mean a family roughly earning $50,000 would still be able to have the benefits for their children of the Healthy Kids program, and we feel that that would be a more reasonable use of Oregon tax dollars to limit it at 250 instead of expanding it so high as 350 as it currently is proposed.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would have to forcefully disagree with this amendment, and for several reasons. One of the recommendations of the Medicaid Advisory Committee, which is made up of citizens of mostly with healthcare backgrounds appointed by the governor, and after talking to many, many families on the road when we were developing this plan, one of the things we heard was that we need to maximize the availability of federal dollars. We can do that up to 300% of the federal poverty line. And we could quibble about the 300 to 350, but to take this down to 250% of poverty would afford us, we would lose federal matching dollars. So I think that is just not cost effective. The more important issue is that when we spoke to families, I think we're losing sight of the fact of how expensive family coverage is today in the state. $11,000, thank you, Mary. It's very expensive. And many families, up to 350, do not have the disposable income to purchase their care for their kids. That's why we have so many uninsured children in the state. The goal of this plan is to provide a helping hand, not a handout, between 200 and 350, sliding scale subsidy to help those families provide health care for their kids, because if they could do it now, they would be doing it. I would argue that there might be some families who wouldn't do it, but the bulk of parents want to have their kids covered. They cannot simply afford it. And that's what this plan does, and taking it down to 250 is simply unacceptable.
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Kotek, I have a daughter who has blessed us with five grandchildren. She and her family, that would be a family of seven, they could earn over $110,000 next year and still qualify to have those kids covered and subsidized by the taxpayers' money. And it's not about quibbling over what percentage should be appropriate. We just feel that if you've got a family of seven that could earn $110,000 and still get government subsidy, maybe that's too much of a shift toward socialized medicine and not enough shift to self-reliance and help those that need it the most. Anyway, that's just the position.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. I'd like us to return to the comments made by Tom Chamberlain from the Oregon AFL-CIO. 91% of the kids who are uninsured in the state are working. And the part of this plan is to make sure that middle-class working families have access to care, and that's what this does. And we can quibble about the income levels, and there are individual cases for any family you talk about, but the bulk of families who are working, who have uninsured children, cannot afford care in the market. They need the type of private-public partnership that this plan provides.
Taking any additional comment, Mr. Chair?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. I just want to raise it within this.
Oh, you'll be brief.
I promise to be brief. This particular issue is one of the biggest issues that I've had with this bill, and the points that Representative Kotek makes – about family affordability. I don't disagree with any of those. I think they're spot on. Nevertheless, I think we still have something we have to grapple with, which is this bill, given that it is rich, and the bar is, I think we can all agree that the bar to get in is pretty low. It creates an artificial magnet. And that's what I have fears about. I think the reasons to be in Oregon or to move in Oregon, if they have to do with your family lives here, you go to school here, you went to school here, you have a job here, or just the quality of life are great reasons to move to Oregon. But when we create an artificial reason incentive to move to Oregon, I have reservations about that, because that has been subsidized on the back of taxpayers. You have to look at it in a little bit of a regional basis, and because I am a big fan of the governor of California, I've been reading his comprehensive health care proposal, and what they're proposing down there, first of all, they're proposing a universal health care system. So this part of it, which they have a similar part of it, is only one part of it. Nevertheless, the part of the California plan that looks a lot like the part of the Oregon plan caps it out at 300. So going to 350, I mean, whether we're 250 or 300, but going to 350 even creates a regional disparity, and that, I have some issues with that. So I just want to get that on the record.
I'd like to comment before we take a vote on this just briefly. First of all, I'd like to say that I think we do too little to help the middle-class families struggling to make a go of it. And we are talking here about upper working-class and middle-class families, and I think we're missing, if we moved it down from 350 to 250, we're missing a great opportunity. The other thing is, there's been a lot of discussion about whether we can talk and compromise and work things out. I believe there was an opportunity to have a discussion and to compromise and to look at that 350 level with some discussion. That this amendment cuts off that opportunity to really have that discussion now, where we could have moved, I think, that line some in. And I think there is a difference between 350, 300, and 250. But as it is, we'll vote on this amendment now. I'll ask the clerk to read, call the roll. All in favor of the amendment, vote aye. Opposed to the amendment, vote no.
Representative
Bonamici.
No.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
No.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Gelser.
No.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kotek.
No.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
No. Well, the motion to amend House Bill 2201 with the -8 amendments fails. I hope we'll have this discussion again in the Revenue Committee as we move it forward.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I have additional amendments that could be entered at this time, but due to the discussion that would probably result relating to the relating clause, and since this bill ultimately is going to go to another committee,
two other committees,
I think it'll be a wise silence to take at this point.
Okay, well, any further discussion on the President of the Kotek's motion to move this bill along to revenue for further discussion? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, yes, sir. I lost you.
That's fine.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Thank you. When we make promises, we should have the capacity to keep them. Kids are valuable and too vulnerable to not keep our promises, and House Bill 2201 does not keep that promise. I am not remotely convinced that this plan is sustainable as proposed. I believe that we will be trapped in a black hole of good intentions. Therefore, I cannot support House Bill 2201.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Bonamici.
Can I have a moment, please, to respond? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to respond to Representative Maurer's comment about sustainability of the plan. This plan has been studied by many, many people, and the proposal that's in the plan for the cigarette tax, there's been a lot of lifeboat analogies here, so I'm going to borrow that and say that if the cigarette tax is a lifeboat, I think we ought to put our children in it. It may not be perfect over the long term, as somebody who just lost a father because of cigarette-related illness. I also agree that if people quit smoking because we raise the cigarette tax, that's a good thing. But
But right now, we have children who need health care. We need to put them in that lifeboat. I don't want to wait and see if we have a lifeboat that may not be quite as shaky while our kids are floundering. So for that reason, I think we need to support this plan the way that it's drafted. There has been enough research to show that it's sustainable in this biennium and in the next. And we can have those discussions further and listen to more ideas as the bill goes into revenue and ways and means. But for now, the sustainability is there, and we need to move this on. Thank you.
Yes.
May I respond?
Sure.
Thank you. And the LFO has suggested that there's a $70 million shortfall in the next biennium, and I don't consider that to be sustainable.
We don't have that in front of us, but the fact is that's not true. What was unsustainable is some other programs funded under the tobacco tax. The LFO analysis indicates there's more than enough money to cover healthy kids out of the tobacco tax in the next biennium. Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I, too, would like to just address that sustainability concept and then also the roll-up concepts with the problems that with language and figures from legislative fiscal office. In the summary analysis of the governor's budget, the legislative fiscal office indicates it has two primary concerns related to this proposal, the proposal being the $181.7 million other funds from increase in tobacco tax. First, the revenue estimate assumes a November 1, 2007 tax increase collection date, which may not be achievable. Second, the revenue projection may be structured on a revenue accrual basis and not a cash basis. Budgeting other funds revenue for the Department of Human Services on a revenue accrual basis rather than cash basis is one of the primary reasons the department encounters end of biennium cash flow issues that require the general fund cash infusions or short-term borrowing from the Treasury, and we know that's been an issue that DHS has been attempting to address. A further quote, while the governor is referred to as 0709 recommended budget as the hope and opportunity budget, the legislative fiscal office has concerns about the sustainability of the proposed budget beyond the 0709 biennium. These concerns are based on a combination of the volatility of Oregon's revenue stream as demonstrated during the past 6 years, the significant commitment of funds in the proposed budget to a wide-ranging number of program enhancements, many of which require considerable additional roll-up costs to continue into the 09-11 biennium and beyond, the reliance on a variety of new taxes, surcharges, and fees for new programs that all require legislative approval, and the inclusion of aggressive capital construction and bonding program leading to increased debt service payments. Now, that is from Legislative Fiscal Office in its analysis. We also have information that from Legislative Fiscal that during the 07-09 biennium does not calculate, or then we move forward to the 09-11 biennium, including roll-up costs, and we end up with a $106.2 million black hole, and therefore that would indicate unsustainability for this current program. That causes me considerable concern. Then I also have contact from my constituents who are telling me that this funding mechanism is probably one of the pieces that we are not talking about enough, and I am, in his behalf, talking about the fact that this is such a regressive tax on the back of the people who can least afford it, and it is not a soft tax, as was referenced in Wednesday's hearing, but a very profound tax for those people. And I will not be supporting the bill in its current form, while I am very, very concerned that we do have a mechanism to address the concerns of health care for children.
Thank you very much. I just want to clarify a point, because not all the committee members have the analysis that's being referred to. The analysis that's being referred to is one that was brought up in a discussion with the Ways and Means staff. And the revenue discussion in that analysis related both to the Healthy Kids Act and to other things the governor's budget proposes doing with the cigarette tax in this and the next biennium. When you roll those other things forward, support for OHB standard, for example, there was not enough money in the tobacco tax to cover the other elements that the governor proposed in his budget. There was more than enough money in their analysis in the tobacco tax to cover the components of the Healthy Kids plan. That $100 million shortfall proposed in that analysis, which you don't have, it's almost like I have this envelope here with a secret analysis in it. that $110 or $140 million shortfall was not related to the Healthy Kids Act in any way. It is sustainable. But that's a question for Ways and Means. Unfortunately, this bill is going both to revenue and Ways and Means, where those things will be clarified. And I think it's best we not deal with Ways and Means and revenue issues in this discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
With all due respect, if there's been what could possibly be perceived as a misunderstanding from what's just been said, then I would think that it would be fair just to clarify one point, by way of clarification. It is true that there will be sufficient tobacco taxes to pay for the Healthy Kids program so long in the next biennium, so long as the other programs that are presently being funded out of tobacco tax are not funded.
Exactly.
But that's a decision that somebody else is going to make, and so and they'll have to do that. But there was a point that Representative Flores made that may not get fully considered, and that is we're dealing with tobacco tax, and tobacco taxes don't come in on the time that they're incurred. It takes a while for that to happen. And so we have a budget based on a cash basis of how much is going to be spent in a two-year period, and it's based on revenues that a substantial amount of which won't even come in during that two-month period, but will come in as long as 90 days after the biennium ends. And so we're creating a hole for the Department of Human Services by merely tying this into the tobacco tax, and this is such an important issue, we ought to be funding it in a way where there's money to pay the bills as they come in and not use tobacco tax as if it's going to be there when in reality much of it will not come in until a following biennium.
Thank you. And I think that's a perfectly good discussion to have in the Revenue Committee and in Ways and Means, and I prefer we not, at this late hour, deal with the revenue question. Are there any other issues in the...
If I may, Mr. Chair?
Thanks.
I promise I'll be brief, because I have a 8-year-old daughter playing basketball in Tualatin at 6 o'clock, which I'm doing the math, and I don't know how it's going to work, Mr. Chair. And it's her very first basketball game. I have a whole list of notes about my problems with this bill, and I'm not going to go through them in the interest of time. I've got a big we've attempted. My bottom line is they're all fixable. I believe the policy aspects of this bill are all fixable. We sort of attempted to do that with these amendments. My problem with this bill is, and if you allow me a little dramatic license, if we could do this
and throw away that half.
Dramatic license?
A restricted license.
Restricted license. And work through this, I think we're there. The problem with this, and of course what I'm doing here is you've got the policy part and you've got the funding part. And I know you're talking about revenue and Ways and Means, but we've got a holistic bill right now. We don't have separate bills, so we have to address it as the full thing. We can talk about the sustainability. I have my own reservations, Mr. Chair, about the sustainability. And what we do know, as a matter of fact, is that whatever the projection is going to be wrong. We still know which direction or how much it's going to be wrong. My biggest problem with the way we're funding it is much more philosophical, in that when we're looking at health care, and we're looking at other states that are looking at health care, Massachusetts, California, to name just a few, the basic concept for where we're heading, universal health care, is shared responsibility. This bill, in my opinion, is very much not shared responsibility. It's all-inclusive, 100% responsibility on the backs of a few, and those few, as has been well discussed, are probably the least able to afford this. We need to have, once again, it's a policy issue and a funding issue, and we have to sort out the funding issue before this bill, in my opinion, is a good bill for the state of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This bill is about shared responsibility. The families from 200% of the federal poverty line up to 350 will be paying, they will be sharing the cost of providing coverage for their children. That is what the framework had set up. It's to make sure that there is shared responsibility. Parents, when we talk to out and around the state, we're like, we want to help out. We just can't do it alone. And what the Healthy Kids Plan provides that joint partnership to make sure our kids have coverage. you know, I listen to the regressivity issues around the tobacco tax, and it's hard for me not to think that they're a bit disingenuous, because all of a sudden we're worried about the very folks that we have left uncovered for years. And if the individuals who oppose the funding source for this would be happy to explain how else we might fund this, because they seem very committed to covering kids, then I'm all ears. This is a funding source that we can make happen that will actually work for kids in our state, and I think we need to support it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and this may not be the forum for it. I've got a half dozen ideas of how we can fund this. Do we wait till revenue?
Absolutely.
Do we wait till revenue? Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, you are asking us to address policy in conjunction with a fiscal discussion.
We are. But we don't have the tools to really deal with the revenue pieces of it. That's what the revenue committee is for. And if we pass it on to them, where there'll be another discussion, it seems to me that's the appropriate place to have it. There are also ways and means discussions, the issues we were talking about what's in the governor's budget to be funded out of tobacco tax. We don't have the tools to deal with that. That's what Ways and Means is for, and they're prepared to deal with it. So I really do think we need to vote on this bill on the policy basis and moving on to the next step for those discussions.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fortunately, Representative Bruin and I will move on together with Healthy Kids to Revenue, and I'm sure we'll have a very healthy discussion about that there and the impact on behaviors and other things. I wanted to build on something that Representative Kotek said. One of the things that I really appreciate about this bill, having been an advocate working with families for a very long time, is for the first time, this is about all of us. And this is something that is not just helping poor kids. It's helping all of our kids. It's helping middle-class kids. It's helping kids that are going to school with a toothache because their parents can't afford dental care. It's helping those people that have been saying for a long time, what happened to me? I'm working hard. I'm doing my part. I'm playing by the rules. I want to pay, but I can't do it all on my own. And once you get above 250% of FPL in this bill, above 200%, it is shared responsibility. And I've been reading some things about free health care for people making $80,000 a year. That's simply not true. People at 350% are paying the full premium for this health care. What we are doing for them is creating a statewide purchasing plan where we have large group coverage for Oregon's kids, bringing that cost of care down for everyone. So the benefit of paying the full premium for two kids being $340 a month as opposed to being $850 per month, as Senator Carter mentioned the other day with her children. So I'm excited to support this bill because I think it's time that the legislature did something that provides some support to the middle class who is working very hard and keeps the state moving along.
Thank you very much. Before we vote on this, I'd like to say thank you to a few people. First of all, it's been really wonderful to have this shared committee with you, Senator Moss Anderson, and your committee members. Your patience has been great, and it's been very, very useful. I want to thank all the people in the audience for all their hard work sitting there and testifying, and it's very much appreciated. And I really want to thank this committee for seriously addressing this issue. This vote will be the first, if we move the bill on, in a very long journey for this, but an important first step, and the first step towards the discussions we're going to have in this session about universal access. Will the committee assistant please read the roll? All in favor of Representative Kotek's motion to move HB 2201 to the Revenue Committee and the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Please vote aye.
Representative
Bonnici. Aye.
Representative Bruin.
No.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
No.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
No.
Vice Chair Kotek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
No.
Chair Greenland.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2201 will be moved to the Revenue Committee and the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 31. Get this right now.
I'd like to close the meeting.
Committee on Health Care. And we're adjourned to also.
Thank you.